everyone. I'm Janet. I'm recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. Happy as always to be here on a Thursday night and excited to talk about probably my favorite chapter in the big book, We Agnostics. So last week we did the first half. We got up to about page 52. So in case you weren't here, just a very quick summary. We Agnostics starts out by kind of defining what an addict is. It says, when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking, or for us eating, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic or a compulsive eater. Then our book says, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness, because we believe this is a disease, which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And we defined a spiritual experience, which the book talks about on page 25. And it's basically God coming in and rewiring our hearts so that my selfish, self-centered priorities get rewired and God's loving and tolerant and caring for others' priorities take over. And that kind of soul soil, the illness of compulsive eating can't live. And it's like a weed that just gets weeded out, gets uprooted. And so that's what this program is about, right? Our step 12 promises us that we will have a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience as the result of these steps. So we know we need that. And then the book goes ahead and defines what our problem is. Not lack of desire, right? Because we all had desire or we wouldn't be here. Not lack of knowledge of how to eat healthy, but our problem is lack of power. And so on page 45, it tells us that's what this book is about. Its main object. So the number one purpose of this big book is to enable us to find a power greater than ourselves, which will solve our problem. Okay, so that's the point of this book. And so we talked about if this power is going to solve our problem, this power has to have a consciousness and be able to think, right? The wind is a power greater than me, but the wind can't think. This power has to be smart. This power has to be strong because this illness is stronger than I am. And last, but definitely not least, this power must care about me. Otherwise, why would he bother trying to solve my problem? So smart, strong, and cares about me. So we have our first clues about God right there. Okay. Then it talked about what gets in the way of finding God. And it talks about page 45, it talks about the six prejudices, page 45 and 46, because there's God, but if we're prejudiced, we can't see him. And prejudice doesn't mean looking down on people of a different race or religion. Sometimes it does, but it's prejudging. And so we can prejudge God. So here are six ways that we prejudge God. One, the concept of God we were given as kids is insufficient. Two, we can't believe in something we can't understand. Three, we think if there was a God, he wouldn't run the universe so poorly. Four, we think people who claim to believe in God aren't very nice. So does God really exist? Five, we think if we believe in God, that makes us weak. And six, if I believe in God, then I can't do what I want. So we talked about that. And we just went and talked about when we first get our first infusion of power. It doesn't come at our first meeting with our first phone call, sponsor, assignment, food plan. It comes as soon as we express, as soon as we're able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we begin to get results. Even though it's impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. So at this meeting, we use the word God, but it's very clear that it's God as each person understands him. It doesn't matter if you're Jewish, Christian, Buddhist, or no religion at all. Our book says the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive to those who earnestly seek. That's the key, right? We have to seek. And it tells us as soon as we start, we begin to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction. So step two is where we get our first infusion of power, provided we take other simple steps. I think each step we get kind of enough power to get us to the next step. It's like if I'm going on vacation, I fill up my tank with gas and it gets me, you know, only so far. It won't get me from New Jersey to California. Not that I would want to leave the best coast for the West Coast anyway, but just hypothetically, one tank of gas isn't going to get me all the way to California. It'll get me a little bit, and then I need to fill up again. So each step gives us more and more power. The only difference is we never reach California. We have to keep filling ourselves with power, even after we've had our spiritual awakening. So we made our way through that, and we ended up talking about the bedevilments on page 52, which are really the problems that a lot of us use when we talk about unmanageability, what defines us, aside from the food problem, that we have trouble with personal relationships, we're miserable, we're depressed, we're full of fear, we can't really seem to be of use to others. And that's about where we left off. So if anyone wasn't here and wants to hear this in depth, there is a recording that was made last Thursday, and someone will put the link in the chat, or you can just find it on recoveryjam.com and look under last week's date. So bottom of page 52, they talk about seeing others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, right? We're sitting there, we don't know what to do, and we're not sure we believe in God. But remember, we get our first clues. He's smart, strong, and cares about us. And you say, okay, yeah, that's like a nice fairy tale, but how do I know that's true? And they say, look at your fellows. There are, you know, 108 people here now, and the odds are at least, you know, half of them have had a spiritual awakening, and a lot more are well on their way to having a spiritual awakening. So person after person can tell you, I used to binge, and then I did this work. I gave my life to God, and God came in and removed the obsession. So that's why it's great we put our number in the chat so we can just keep talking with each other and learning this. So now let's talk about the Wright brothers, the guys who built that first airplane. Chaya, can you read for us bottom of 52, please? I need you to unmute.
Thought I was unmuted. Okay. The Wright brothers' almost childish faith that they could build a machine which would fly was the mainspring of their accomplishment. Without that, nothing could have happened. We agnostics and atheists were sticking to the idea that self-sufficiency would solve our problems. When others showed us that God's sufficiency worked with them, we began to feel like those who had insisted the Wrights would never fly.
So this is interesting. It tells us that the Wright brothers' almost childish faith that they could build an airplane was the mainspring of their accomplishments. That's so weird. If we were asked to fill in the blank, right? What was the most important thing, the mainspring of the Wright brothers? I would say like their aeronautical or mathematical ability or their understanding of gravity. But they say faith. And they go so far as to say that if they didn't have faith, nothing could have happened. Why? And I talked about it last week, but I think this is just so important. Because in the spiritual world, faith is the currency, and that's how things get done. Faith activated generally by prayer. So if you think about it, if a Martian just landed on planet Earth and followed me around, he might see me going to the grocery store and handing the clerk a credit card for a bag of groceries. And then he might see me going to the gas station and handing the clerk a $20 bill to get my gas filled. So he'd see this me handing him this little green and white piece of paper with a picture of a president. And he'd go back to Mars and say, you know, on Earth, it's weird the way they do things. They hand people a piece of plastic or a piece of green and white paper and they get stuff. But that's how transactions are done on Earth. But in the spiritual world, I can't just go up to God and hand him a $20 bill. What's the currency in the spiritual world? And they say faith. Faith actually gets things done. That if I believe, right? That's why we have a second step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We don't have that with pneumonia. No one has to believe that penicillin will restore them to health. But because this is not a physical illness like pneumonia, but one that's partly physical, but the main part is spiritual, recovery has to start on a spiritual level with faith. And so we have to come to believe in God, that God could restore us to sanity. Otherwise, how on earth are we going to take step three and turn our will and our lives over to God? It would be lunacy for me to turn my will and my life over to an entity that I don't trust. So we have to come to believe in and trust. And right, even more, how could I turn my life over to something I don't believe in? I'm not going to turn my will and my life over to Santa Claus. So they say, okay, others showed us God's sufficiency worked with them, and we began to feel like those who insisted the rights would never fly. Well, how did they feel, those people who insisted that the rights would never fly? I think they were skeptical, but they changed their minds when they saw the evidence. Guys, we are supposed to be the evidence for each other and for the newcomers, right? That's why we show up, you know, lipstick on, hair combed, so that someone will look at us and say, I want what she has. I want what he has. And they continue on page 53, and they start talking about logic. And they say, you know, we think, you know, logic is important. We're not going to say people shouldn't have logic, but it only gets us so far. And it says, when we became alcoholics or compulsive eaters, crushed by a self-imposed crisis. Love that, a self-imposed crisis. I was the cause of it, right? Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of this illness. But once it started, I couldn't help it. Couldn't help it. And so then it's a crisis. I can't postpone it and I can't evade it. And I have to look and say, either God is everything, either God's going to be my everything or nothing. No halfways, which means he can't be God of my food, but not God of how I file my income tax and whether or not I lie on them. He's everything or nothing. And it says, what is our choice to be? Well, that's interesting. They're telling me that faith can be a choice. So it's a decision, right? And someone could say, okay, I don't really know if God exists, so I'm going to choose to believe that God exists. So it tells us that's our choice. Faith can be a decision. And then I can say, well, if there is a God who exists, this God probably wants me to behave in a certain way, probably doesn't want me to cheat on my income tax, wants me to be nicer to other people. So we start acting that way. That's what it says earlier in this chapter, that we don't have to have it all together to start putting spiritual principles into practice. So we can do what we know. And then they say, okay, logic is great, but now let's talk about faith. And they're saying, and don't tell me that you don't have any faith. And I looked up the word faith, and it says a belief that is not based on proof. So every time I flick a light switch, right, I've got faith that it's going to. Now, I don't see the electricity in the wires, but I have faith it's going to come on. When I go to sit on a chair, I don't test it every time to make sure it's going to hold me. I have faith that a chair is going to hold me. When I go to eat breakfast, I don't assume there's going to be poison in the food, right? So we have faith all day long for all kinds of things that we don't even think about. We have faith. So now we can just decide we're going to have faith in God, that there is a God, that he exists, and that he cares about us. And then it goes further on page 54. It says, not only do we have faith, we worship. We're hardwired to worship. And I looked up the word worship today, and it says adoring reverence. And I looked up reverence, and it says respect and awe. So adoring, that's like almost more than love. And respect, right? I can love someone or something I don't respect. And awe, like a feeling of wonder. So adoration, respect, and wonder. And it says, okay, you may think you're not worshiping God, but you're worshiping something. We're all worshiping something. And it tells us what we worship. Other people, right? Who of us hasn't had that bad boyfriend who we worshiped and acted against our better judgment time and again, even though our friends are telling us not to talk for another time. Sentiment, the idea of just like being in love, things, right? If only when I get that new car, new necklace, new pair of boots, money, and ourselves, right? I want everyone else in the world to do my bidding, ourselves. We worship them. And it says, okay, but sometimes we have better motives and we might like look at the sunset or the sea and feel worshipful. And what they're saying is, this has nothing to do with reason. Us looking at a starry night and just saying, this is just breathtaking. It's not that we sit there and say, it is dark. There are about 50 stars in the sky. It looks pretty. The canvas of yellow stars against black. We don't do that. It's not reason. There's just something inside us that is just like calling us to worship. We are hardwired to worship. So it tells us at the bottom of that paragraph on page 54, it's impossible to say we have no capacity for faith. Right? We all believe in something. For love, we all love something, even if it's just our own comfort, and worship. And just as an aside, I have a note in my margin here. It's important to worship. Yes, we surrender to God. We love God. We try to do what God wants, but we want to spend some time worshiping him. That's why it's like generally a good prayer practice to include like some praise, like to think of some attribute of God, like God is merciful, God is forgiving, God is like all seeing, all loving, God is fair. And to just like, God, I worship you for that. I praise you for that. Because if we don't worship God, by default, we're going to end up worshiping something or someone else. So we want to be intentional about worshiping God. Okay, and then top of 55, they say, okay, you know, what about our best minds might sometimes be wrong, right? The people who said the world is flat, the people who said man could never fly. Well, that they believed was true until they saw that it wasn't. And then they just switch and they kind of get poetic on us on page 55. They say, yet we've been seeing another kind of flight. Forget about the Wright brothers. We're going beyond airplanes. A spiritual liberation from this world. People who rose above those problems. They said, God made these things possible and we only smiled. We'd seen spiritual release, but like to tell ourselves it wasn't true. And I thought, huh, if I saw someone who had this great spiritual release. Why would I tell myself, yeah, this can't be true? And I just thought back to my pre-recovery days. And a lot of times I would rather be right than be healed. I would rather be right than, you know, have to do some work to connect with God. I would rather be right than pretty much anything else. And so we have to get to the point where it doesn't matter if we're right. All that is pride anyway. You know, it's good that we're wrong sometimes. It helps keep us humble. So then my favorite line in the book, actually, we were fooling ourselves. Okay, now here comes the good part. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Okay, to me, that line kind of takes my breath away, because what it says, deep down in everyone. So when God created us, we all have some things in common, right? Some of us may have blue eyes and some brown eyes, but we all, unless there's, you know, just a big like problem, have like two lungs, two kidneys, a heart. God created that, right? That was his blueprint, and it's in everyone. And so is the fundamental idea of himself. So when God was forming me, my lungs, my kidneys, my stomach, my heart, right in there somewhere is the fundamental idea of himself, that he loves us so much. He planted the idea of himself right inside of us. But we talked about some things that get in the way, right? Our prejudices. And now they talk about other things that can obscure it. It's like I can't drive at night much anymore because I'm starting to get cataracts. So I don't see very well. Things are blurry at night. And here they're talking about spiritual cataracts, what obscures our view of God. And they talk about three things: calamity, pomp, and worship of other things. Calamity. This is what Bill Wilson talked about on page 11 when Ebby came to him. He said, yeah, I can believe in like this general spirit of the universe, but you know, I was in a war. I saw, you know, war, chicanery, and basically it seems like the devil's the boss. He actually said that. If there is a devil, he seemed the boss universal. So his view was obscured by calamity. And Ebby didn't argue with him. He just basically said, I don't know about all that stuff. All I know is once I gave my life to God, God took the obsession to drink right out of me. So when I'm saying that God shouldn't allow human trafficking or cancer or my kids to not listen to me, what I'm really saying is I know better than God how the universe should run. And I have proven time and again, I'm very underqualified for the job of God. So calamity. So we have to kind of work our way through it, right? When it says we have to search fearlessly, this is what we have to do: get rid of our prejudices and our spiritual cataracts. By pomp, worship of myself. That means that everyone should do what I think. And basically, everyone should only do and say things that make my life easier. No one should ever criticize me because that makes me uncomfortable. No one should ever not do what I say because that's inconvenient to me. Pomp. How do we get over that? By just saying, people can say what they want. People can do what they want. I have a role to play, and that's to do God's will as to the best of my ability. And then people can say what they want, do what they want. Not that it never bothers us, but it's like it bothers us, I guess, an inch instead of a football field. And worship of other things, other people, our careers, our possessions. So things like that. Those things obscure our view of God. So we want to look at them. Those things are basically our idols, right? An idol is anything that we put ahead of God. And I'll just say for me, my biggest one for years it wasn't so much my children, like, are they going to get into a good college and grow up to be, you know, doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs? And are they going to, you know, marry well and give me perfect grandchildren? It wasn't that with my children. For me, my idol was that I mattered to my children. That when I grew up, or when they grew up and I was old, they wouldn't forget about me. They wouldn't ignore me, that I would matter to them. And that was such an idol that I parented out of that fear. So often, if we look at our fear of what our fears, something we're deathly afraid of losing, we can see where our idols are. So we got to get rid of them. And I can talk about that later, how a way to get rid of idols. So then they go ahead and they say, faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in our lives are facts as old as man himself. As old as, you know, going back to, I guess, the Garden of Eden. So they say, not just faith, but miraculous demonstrations. What good is faith without power? It's useless. You know, it gets me like pretty poems and stuff like that. But that's not what I needed. I needed a rewiring of my heart and the obsession with food expelled. And they just continue on by talking about how we have to sweep away prejudice, think honestly, right? Like just because the nun hit us with a ruler when we went to Catholic school when we were kids, doesn't mean that all religious people, you know, are bad tempered. We have to start thinking honestly and start thinking, just because I have a thought in my head doesn't mean it's true. And search diligently. That's why I know when I sponsor people, I always give them an assignment, spend 30 minutes in the morning with God. Prayer, meditation, spiritual reading, because this is about developing a relationship. And when we want a relationship with someone, we have to spend time with them. And they say, okay, if you do this, you cannot fail. And they close with one of my favorite stories in the book, the story of our friend, the minister's son. And it's on page 56 here, but his full story is our Southern friend, that starts on page 208 of the big book. So it talks about, here he is in a mental institution and he doesn't get it. He doesn't understand. And so he goes to someone who seems to have his act together, a fellow patient there, and he asks for help. And he says, I'll do anything. So again, he had that willingness to go to any lengths. And then the man says to him, if you're willing to do anything, then all your troubles are over. So the minister's son goes back into his room and he's like, I don't get it. If there is a God, he certainly hasn't done anything for me, but he's open-minded and he asks the question. See, here it is. He goes from agnostic, atheist, and he opens up his mind. He says, is it possible that all the religious people I have known are wrong? And then God came. Because even though he was asking it maybe in a surly way, is it possible that all the religious people I've known are wrong? He's open-minded. And you could almost hear in his heart, while he's saying that, he's like, maybe the religious people are right and maybe there is hope for me. And a quick story, I had a sponsor once, wonderful woman in Georgia. She and her husband lived near a military base and they had AA meetings for the soldiers. They went and they picked them up because the army wouldn't bus them there. And one time she was talking about God and one of the soldiers said, I'll believe in God if I see a burning bush. Well, that was what the guy said, but I have to believe that the prayer in his heart was, God, it would be so awesome if you were real. Because right after he made that surly remark, the potted plant she had there, this big potted plant, fell over onto a halogen lamp and caught fire. And he had the burning bush, and it had such an effect on the soldiers that after that, the army sent a busload of them over there. She and her husband didn't have to get them because God hears the prayer of our hearts. So here's a minister's son. He's saying, maybe I'm wrong. And then God appears. And what does he do? He does the only thing possible when God appears. He tumbled out of bed to his knees. And then he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. And the obsession was removed. Beautiful story. And it goes into even more detail in our Southern friend, because I think it's important that we know that, and we'll talk about this next week when we start talking about step three. We can't just go to God and say, okay, God, I'll believe in you. So the minister's son had gone to his friend, the other patient there, and says, I must ask you a question. How does prayer fit into this thing? So he hears God saying, who are you to say there is no God? He's filled with love, but he's thinking, okay, I got to do more. And so his friend answers, well, you've probably tried praying like I have. When you've been in a jam, you've said, God, please do this or that. And if it turned out your way, that was the last of it. And if it didn't, you said, there isn't any God, or he doesn't do anything for me. Is that right? Yes. Yes, I reply. I would have replied yes too. That isn't the way, the man continued. The thing I do is to say, God, here I am, and here are all my troubles. I've made a mess of things and can't do anything about it. Take me and all my troubles and do anything you want with me. Does that answer your question? Yes, it does, the minister's son answers. He says this, I return to bed. It doesn't make sense. I feel a wave of utter hopelessness. I'm in the bottom of hell. And there a tremendous hope is born. It might be true. I tumble out of bed onto my knees. I know not what I say, but slowly a great peace comes to me. I feel lifted up. I believe in God. I crawl back into bed and sleep like a child. And if we go back to We Agnostics, page 57, it says he never drank again after that. And they say, another wonderful line, what is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Guys, they are telling us the elements to create a miracle are simple, like the elements to, you know, bake bread or, you know, cook oatmeal. Like, here's the recipe for a miracle. One, circumstances made him willing to believe, willing to go to any lengths. And step one, he humbly offered himself to his maker. Step two, step three, then he knew. And then it concludes by saying, even so, like whenever any of us do that, follow that recipe, God restored us all to our right minds. The minister's son had a revelation that was sudden. Some of us grow into it more slowly, but here's the promise. He has come to all, that's 100%. Of those who honestly sought him. When we draw near to him, he discloses himself to us. So stick around, guys, because next week we're going to get into step three and the miracle is coming. We say here all the time, the age of miracles is still with us. And it really and truly is. And this book gives us the recipe. And with that, I pass.